Well, good day and welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are back with another great segment for you tonight. And I'm really excited about getting into the meat of tonight's episode. But before we get to that, we have to move things over to our co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how are things out in Colorado land?
It hasn't been too terribly hot, and I'm kind of hoping it stays that way. We can still get the afternoon thunderstorms, so that cools things off a bit. But we're not going to talk about the weather tonight because our weather people are both on holiday driving or flying somewhere. So we hope they have a good time. But we do have Dr. Joe, wherever Dr. Joe is. Where are you, Dr. Joe?
I am actually in central Arkansas at the moment, believe it or not. At the lake. So, I'm sort of on holiday, but you know, you're never really on holiday. So glad to be participating.
Well, I'm just glad you had enough bandwidth to get in here because you're going to be an important part of this conversation. So we have two guys tonight that you talked to at this conference you went to, and they graciously agreed to be with us. So this is going to be an awesome conversation. So Joe, you want to talk a little bit about that conference, and then we'll introduce the two of them.
Yeah, so I've known both Daniel and Nick for quite a while. You know, we've deployed together many times, although our connection has been somewhat distant over those several deployments. But I ran into both these guys at this big educational operational readiness exercise that we did not long ago in central Indiana, I think is where that was. And finally had a chance to really connect with them and, you know, make it happen to get both these guys on. They've been in the USAR system for a long time and have some amazing experiences, et cetera. And really so excited to have both these guys on. They're just it's been way too long, and glad to have you guys both on board. So I'll throw it back to you, Sam, if you want to do some detailed introductions, and we'll get rolling.
That I would. Yeah, one would be awesome, but the two of them is double awesome. So, Dr. Nick, you're in Ohio. Tell us what you do and what your role is in USAR.
Yeah, so thanks again for having me. I'm a professor of emergency medicine at Ohio State, and I spend most of my time in the academic world. I was previously our emergency medicine clerkship director, and now I oversee the fourth year of medical school at OSU. But my clinical interest is really all surrounding emergency preparedness and disaster response. So I've been a medical manager for Ohio Task Force One since 2010 or so, and have been, as my kids get a little bit older, been getting a little bit more involved with FEMA and the USAR world.
Yes, and we have stories to tell. So, Dr. Dan, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate you inviting us to this, and you know, we're excited to share some stories and information with you guys. My background is somewhat similar to Nick in that I also work at Ohio State. I'm an emergency physician, associate professor in our department. But the other thing that I have in my background is some military time. Prior to Ohio State, I was a physician in the Navy. I had specialty training in dive medicine. So one of the other hats that I wear currently is director of hyperbaric medicine at Ohio State Medical Center. And then I also am director for disaster preparedness for our medical center. One of the things that, you know, Nick and I have collaborated on is a disaster medicine and emergency response elective course for our fourth year medical students that we have developed over the last 5 years now. This is the fifth iteration of it. And so, you know, with our our academic proclivity. It's how we've worked in the operational experience that we have with the academic roles that we play. Again, like Nick, I'm on the Ohio Task Force One FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Team, just like Joe. And we all have several deployments under our belts at this point. So again, thanks for having me.
Alwyn, can't wait to talk about some of those. In fact, we'll start with you, Dr. Nick. You wanted to discuss social media, and you have a great story about Harvey in Houston and how social media helped you find a number of elders in a nursing home. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I've been interested in social media for a while and kind of how we can use smartphone technology in a disaster. Things like fire chat and, the WhatsApp and things to communicate and how to use a smartphone. And I know in my day-to-day job in the emergency department, if, we get multiple victims from a wreck or we find out something happened, one of the first things I do is go to Twitter. And so I stayed pretty active on social media while I was on deployment, kind of when I had time to check in. And there was a pretty famous picture of some elders in a nursing home that were chest high in floodwater. And I guess just to kind of remind you, Hurricane Harvey happened in 2017, and they got about 50 inches of rainfall in like 3 days. And that's their typical rainfall over the course of the year. So what we had to deal with most was a lot of flooding issues. So after that Twitter picture kind of went viral and was featured in a bunch of news articles, we got a mission to evacuate a nursing home with 85 patients. There were 20 staff members, and the staff members all had their families in the nursing home with them because most of them, their living shelter in their house was flooded. So we were fortunate enough to do this mission with Nebraska, and we showed up at a church and found out where the nursing home was. We had two box trucks, and we arrived at the nursing home to find out that about 30 of the patients were bedridden, and it was also a memory care nursing home, so there was a lot of Alzheimer's patients there as well. So it was a pretty complicated task for what would turn out to be our first mission. This was on, we left, I think, early Friday morning. This would have been early Monday morning once all the rain started over the course of that Sunday. And so I think, it was an interesting example of the news spreading fast that there were elders in nursing home in need of rescue. And, I'm happy to say that the National Guard met us there with two large, high-riding vehicles. And we were able to, we started with the ambulatory patients that we were able to essentially load onto the ramp of our box truck and then bring to, there was actually a truck stop nearby where there was a strike force of ambulances waiting to take these nursing home patients to three separate nursing homes. And so we loaded those patients up, and then we went with the non-ambulatory patients second, and then the bedridden patients third. And one of the things that I think really resonated with me that I wasn't expecting is the fact that Houston had experienced a fair amount of flooding prior to Hurricane Harvey. There's the Buffalo Bayou that goes through the middle of the city that's flooded before. And as the only physician at this site, it was kind of my job to make sure that all the patients were fit for transport. And some of them were on tube feeds and IV fluids. And it was a fairly complicated situation. But one of the things that I think I'll just offer your listeners is each patient at the nursing home had a vest. And each vest had the patient's name, medical history, meds, allergies, and code status. And I have to tell you that if they hadn't pre-prepared the patients in that way, this would have been a lot more challenging situation than what it already was, clearly very challenging. I was fortunate that they did have medical charts on each of the patients, and for the ones that needed medicine or that were sick, I was able to kind of look them up. But I have to say that, and I've brought this back to Columbus to some of the nursing homes that we collaborate with, I thought it was really a best practices in how to transport patients that are potentially going to go to a place you're not sure where they're going to end up. And as you all know, in disasters, patient tracking can be very difficult, and I'm sure you've had podcasts on this. But I think, you know, for me, that was one of the most interesting missions that I was involved with, and it really all started off of a tweet. So I thought it was kind of an interesting example of how social media can impact, you know, how FEMA responds to these. I'll also say that later in the deployment, there were some Facebook messages sent where we would go out on a mission and look for a patient that was either under a bridge or in a tree or something and maybe not find that person. So I think there's some good and some bad with that. Joe was our IST or lead physician there. So I'd be curious to hear how the incident support team handles social media requests to go rescue someone somewhere in a disaster. So I'll finish there, and I'd love to hear what y'all have to say about that.
Joe, you want to take that?
Well, so great conversation. I mean, honestly, as I was listening to this, I was thinking of the nursing home at Katrina, which had many of the same issues, although the social media component was not really engaged there. What was very similar was the issues related to a nursing home where the majority of people that I was required to evacuate from that facility had memory issues or Alzheimer care type issues. And by that, I mean, there were about 85 patients there, the majority of whom had pretty severe dementia. Most of them had no ability to communicate not only who they were, but their medical history or anything else. And there were only four or five people that were the caretakers, nursing administration of that nursing home facility that knew all of those people and could communicate all of their complicated medical histories. And the challenges that we faced in moving those people literally all the way across the country, knowing that when they arrived at the other end, they would not be able to tell anybody anything about themselves. And I had great concerns about the ability to identify those patients, ensure that their medical history flowed with them to wherever they were being temporarily housed and in some cases permanently housed. You know, if you look at this from a very pragmatic standpoint, the ability to ensure that those folks' Social Security, Medicare, and insurance benefits followed them to wherever they were sent to so that they could be continued to be cared for, and that care could be paid for, and that their family could find them and ensure that the benefits that they were entitled to were appropriately administered to them. So, you know, I think the one of the key things I heard out of that was related to the amazing job that preparedness had to do with that, in the ability of Nick and, you know, everybody that was working at Harvey to be able to pull that data out and find a way to send that to the final destination, and what a challenge that really is. On to sort of Nick's specific question related to, you know, the challenges that we have with social media. Sorry about that. Hopefully she'll stop. So part of the issues we had related to social media is that we too, at the IST, the incident support team level, got lots of those social media requests, comments, taglines, et cetera, related to, you know, there's a friend of mine whose mom is in X nursing home, and he hadn't heard from her, and can you go check on her, and all that sort of stuff. We queued those up and tried to respond to those in the same way that we did 911 calls that were coming in. We too had several instances where we got a specific message from a family member, for example, via social media, who said, my mom and I always communicate on Facebook, and I haven't heard from her, and she's at the following location, and, you know, here's the address. Could somebody please go check on them? And we followed every one of those up with whatever resources we had available to do so. So the social media piece of that was very valuable. It's hard to work through the, you know, there's a lot of noise in that signal, and figuring out which ones of those are really legit and which ones of those are not is challenging. And I think that's something that I'd love to hear from both Dan and Nick on sort of their thoughts on how do we pull the signal out of the noise.
Dan, you want to take that one, then go to Nick on it.
Yeah, sure. So that's, you know, that's tough. I think right now we're overloaded with data. You know, I think we've moved from a era probably prior to, you know, me and Nick. I know Joe's been with the system for a while, so has more institutional experience. But we've moved from a time where we were data hungry to a time where we're, again, you know, data deluged. I don't have a succinct great answer to your question, Joe. You know, I think anecdotally, my experience from Florence, which was, you know, fall of 2018, was that where we were working was pretty rural. It was in North Carolina, and we relied heavily on the local volunteer fire department that we were using as our forward base, and really filtered all of the information through them, whether it was, you know, coming formally through the 911 system, or it was the, you know, social media, word of mouth, you know, other forms of communication that, you know, were at play during that event. So I think that the, you know, the local infrastructure, if it's intact at all, is definitely one of the things that you can use to filter some of that noise. But, you know, that, I don't think that's all of it. And, you know, that, again, was an anecdotal experience in one community for one event. So I'm not sure I can necessarily, you know, as an academic person, you know, an N of one is not really something that you want to extrapolate, to a whole system necessarily. Nick, what do you think? What are your thoughts?
Well, I agree. I mean, I guess I keep kind of going back to, the whole purpose of disaster preparedness is to do the most good for the most amount of people. And to go on a wild goose chase for someone who's, voiced on social media that they know someone who might not be safe, I mean, I think that would be tough. I think you have to try to let local response do that. It's hard for big teams to move around, in these types of disasters where the infrastructure isn't great. I guess the other thing I would just add that we saw a lot in Houston was people helping each other, civilians helping each other. And, I think one of the things, we're in the middle of a heat wave, at least here in Columbus, we always advocate people check on their neighbors. So I guess my thought would be everyone's so connected now on social media that hopefully they know someone that can check on that person. And then maybe a FEMA team doesn't need to necessarily do that. I think our services are best rendered, on a larger scale. I guess that would be my thought, but I also would just say that I don't think social media is going anywhere. I know, Facebook actually has a safety check function where people can check in as being safe when they're in a disaster. And, I guess in the same way that you would search a house that doesn't have any activity, when we were doing search and rescue through the neighborhoods, we'd look for the houses to have everything pushed outside. And the ones that didn't have any activity, we would, try to figure out what was going on. So I think I love that we're having this conversation because I think it's only this issue is only going to grow and we're going to have to deal with it when we're on these deployments. But I suppose I would wrap up my thoughts by saying, hopefully as, civilians or people that are impacted by a disaster, we can check on each other. And then when FEMA or DMAT teams or other teams come in to respond, they can do the ones that are a little bit more on a larger scale. I don't even know if that's right.
Well, as a DMAT, we appreciate that. Go ahead, Joe.
I was just going to say, I think that's beautifully said. What I hope is that as social media and its functionality in disaster situations gets more experience, we have the ability to incorporate AI and other kinds of algorithmic evaluations of social media content that help us tease out more of the real signal from the noise. And I think it's just another methodology by which we pull in data from the field. That's very much about what USAR has been about for a long time, in that USAR teams are very comfortable in collecting data in the field, whether that's related to damage assessments, sheltering in place, need for specific services, et cetera. We've been doing that for a long time, and our methodology continues to grow and get better and better in how we do that. And I think as the networks grow, and as artificial intelligence related to those networks grows, we'll get better and better information out of the the social media context, which is, you know, very large and has a lot of data, maybe not a lot of information, but we'll get better at extracting information out of all that data that's flying around out there.
Jamie, what are your thoughts on all of this so far?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things I wish was Kyle was here, because he's our social media and disaster educator and talks a lot about this when he goes around the country and does the teaching that he does. It's interesting because we, you know, from as following those different disaster situations like Harvey and others from a distance, social media played a huge role in getting information out to the rest of the country about what was going on there. And I think while it may have caused certain issues for the local responders and the federal responders who came into that area, it served a very important purpose to mobilize the nation to get behind helping with that situation in various ways, whether it was non-governmental agencies, support through federal and through congressional resources, whatever the case may be. So there was another whole facet to support for the disaster response that came at a distance, I think, from that social media footprint, that is something that I don't think a lot of people talk about. And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Disaster Podcast. We've cut this one into two parts. There's just so much great information here from both Nicholas and Dan. Both are going to come back and finish up this episode in next week's show. So stay tuned for that. We'll have Nick, Dan, Joe, Sam, and myself back. In the meantime, I do want to remind everybody to thank Paragon Medical Education Group for their continued support of the show. They do so much to make sure that this episode and all the other episodes like it come out to you every week. And if you are looking for a unique training and educational experience that will be a major portion of your preparedness operation for the next year, I think you can't go wrong by reaching out to them. So check them out at paragonmedicalgroup.com, also over at paragonmededu on Twitter, and over at the Disaster Podcast website and via their Facebook group, Paragon Medical Education Group. We want to thank them again for all their support and urge you to reach out to them and tell them you heard about it here on the Disaster Podcast. That's it for this episode. We'll be back again, as I said, next week. And until then, just want to remind you, as Sam always says, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.